Welcome to the Hot Literati. The Hot Literati is my collective of hot, cool, well-read people. My name is Haley, and I'm so happy that you're here. So I'm posting this on a Monday, hopefully, kind of late. But I'd like to get to a cadence of maybe posting or uploading something once a week on Sunday, so long as it's manageable and fun, and I feel like I have something relevant to say. But yeah, you guys have given me a lot of really great feedback. I know y'all love the podcast, so I'm going to do my best to get a little more regular with it. So today I'm going to be talking about something that I'm calling female insanity in the work of Kate Chopin. I'm fairly new to Kate Chopin. I picked up The Awakening and this collection of some of her other stuff at the Newark airport on my way back to Kansas on a recommendation from a new friend who I think is very similar to me in a lot of ways. Like, we seem to have what we've referred to as big hearts, fast minds, or big hearts, fast brains, because we're both kind of overthinkers and like compassionate to a fault. He recommended that I read The Awakening, and oh boy, it did kind of rock my world. So The Awakening is this story set in the 19th century, I believe, because this collection, I think she was writing in the late 19th century. So it's very, like, for me at least, it felt reminiscent of like themes you would read in like Austen or Bronte, where there's a lot of like social pageantry, and those are kind of the responsibilities that women have, as well as like keeping the house, like being a wife, paying visits to one another. And obviously, just given like the environment that these stories are written about, a lot of them are also depicting like the lives of white women in very privileged situations. Though this is something I can return to later as well, but Kate Chopin, because she was, a lot of her work is about America and the South, specifically like New Orleans. So a lot of her work is actually extremely sympathetic towards Black people, which I think is really radical for her time as well. And there's like one story that's super interesting where the protagonist is actually a biracial woman who doesn't know that she's part Black until her husband, who is white, white passing, that's like the twist at the end, is that he's actually not white. But there are these stories where she also like embodies a Black character in a way that affords them a lot of humanity and like a lot of interiority, which is really rare for her time. So I really appreciate that, because that's something that as a person of color is always like, you never know if, you know, with an author who is writing at this time period, it could go either way. So it's always nice when it's not like super disparaging, just given the time period. So The Awakening is this story about a woman, I think her name is Edna, and she's married to this man and she has two children, and then she's kind of like awoken, per the title. And she realizes one day that she's completely like unfulfilled as a mother and a wife, and she starts to live like solely for herself and for her own desires. And I had a TikTok about Chopin and The Awakening specifically. I think it's almost at like 100,000 views now, so it was performing pretty well. But I think this is a really relevant topic right now, just because Emma Ratajkowski started this really interesting conversation online about like divorce and being divorced by the age of 30 and how that feels as a woman, and how it actually affords you this like second life in a way to pursue like what you really want to pursue with like a fully developed like prefrontal cortex and like hopefully money of your own and things like that. So like the episode on the bell jar, I'm going to go through some of my annotations in The Awakening and then some of the other stories and touch on themes and excerpts that I found really interesting and relevant. So the first thing that I underlined was her describing Edna's husband. And it says that she is the sole object of his existence, because I underlined that because, I mean, goals, but also, like, I realized throughout The Awakening and some of the other works that Chopin seems to have this really interesting depiction of male characters. And one thing that I'm really into, just, like, reading The Mind's Eye by Hofstadter right now, is this idea of, like, subjective bias. Like, obviously, Chopin's never going to be able to afford like full interiority to men the same way men never afford like full interiority to like female characters, and same with like any, you know, identity like that. But it is really interesting when they try to get close. Like, I think Faulkner and Joyce have really interesting excerpts where they try to get like as close as they can to a woman's interiority, and I think that their attempts are very like earnest, and I think it's something that we shouldn't ignore. And the same thing with Chopin's attempt to depict like male characters. Like, she affords a lot of sympathy to Edna's husband. He's not depicted as like bad or cruel. The woman kind of just begins, Edna just begins to realize that they prioritize like different things. Like, he's very into wealth, he's very into like the pageantry of society, and Edna comes to realize that those are things that like actually don't matter to her at all. And she feels like a little taken aback or like disgusted when he has some like big exercise, or like he like shows how important those things are to him. Yeah, so this is another excerpt that I thought was really interesting. She was beginning to realize her position in the universe as a human being and to recognize her relations as an individual to the world within and about her. And per like my friend who recommended this and us saying like big hearts, fast brains, I think that that's one reason why Chopin, and even like going back to Plath's work, really resonates with a lot of people. And I talked about this so much in the episode on the bell jar, is I think there's a type of person that just has like an extremely hyperactive mind, and it can lend you to like observing the beauty in the world like to the point of tears, but I think it can also skew toward like feeling really, really bad sometimes. And like for art, for my writing, you know, I like dance between those two feelings, but sometimes it is almost like more enviable to find a nice like happy medium, which based on Chopin's work, I don't know if her characters ever really do, or it seems like a lot of her male characters actually do, from her perspective, but again, she can't afford them like full interiority because she doesn't know what it's like to be them. And this quote, like, even as a child, she had lived her own small life all within herself. At a very early period, she had apprehended instinctively the dual life, that outward existence which conforms, the inward life which questions. And again, we're at that like hyperactive mind, like that Carsey Headrest lyric I adore, we're like dancing inside our own heads. And it can be really fun sometimes, but it can also be really hard. And I think it makes it difficult to find people that you feel like you can be honest with and you can be compatible with as well. And I don't remember if I mentioned this in the episode on the bell jar, but I've been getting really into the philosopher Schopenhauer, who's like the father of pessimism. And he has this whole theory of like life is a tragic comedy, and the ability to like take off your mask or put it back on. And one thing I'm like coming to realize, I don't know if it's just like being an adult in the real world and getting older, or like going back and forth on this pendulum in my own head so much, or like meeting other people that do the same thing, but I think you have to be willing to put on the mask, right? Like, you have to be willing to participate in the play to an extent. And Schopenhauer definitely writes this, because the alternative is extremely lonely and kind of insane. And we talked about this in the bell jar, and that's why I'm titling this Female Insanity as well, is when Edna, the character in The Awakening, starts to like abandon all of her responsibilities and like just do whatever she wants to do, like ignoring visits and like running around with men who are not her husband, and like not spending time with her children, which arguably she wasn't really doing much of, because she had like someone else taking care of her children who's probably like a woman of color. But her husband's first instinct is to go to the doctor and to say like, look, this is what's happening with my wife, like I think she's sick, I think she's going crazy, because, and we talked about this in the bell jar a book club, and I think I talked about it in the last episode, a lot of the time that's a relegation that we give to people who don't conform to societal expectations. Like in the bell jar, like Esther Plath's character like really struggles with not wanting to be a wife someday, and in The Awakening, Edna struggles with like being a wife and realizing that maybe she doesn't want to be a wife or mother, and like taking steps back from that. But I am coming to one realization, I feel like, in my own life that I want to talk about with this line of thinking, and I want to turn to another one of Chopin's stories in order to do so. I think this might be one of my favorite short stories ever now, low-key. It's called, I think, Athénaïs. There's a lot of French in her work, I'm assuming because, like, New Orleans has a heavy, like, Creole French influence. But it's about this woman, I think girl is more appropriate because she seems really young in the story, who is married to this man named Cazot, and she like marries him, and then she realizes like, oh no, I don't want to be married to this man. And her brother, who seems like a hothead, like comes and gets her and like brings her home, and then Cazot, her husband, like goes and gets her again, and she's wanting him to be like cruel and like stern and put his foot down so she can have this like huge fit and not go with him in front of her family. But he doesn't. He's like relatively chill. He's like, come on, like, let's go home. And she does. But when she's home, she's just like seething against him because she doesn't want to be his wife. And her brother and herself like orchestrate this huge plan to just like have her leave. And the brother basically sets her up in an apartment in the city for a month, and she's like, okay, like, they steal out from under the nose of the husband, like, the husband wakes up, and she's just gone. So then she's in this apartment alone, and she's there for a month. She tells herself she's gonna get a job, she has, like, a couple new dresses made, and then, there's a man at the apartment as well, who's, like, very literary, like a little bit older. I was cracking up because I think in my head this second character is literally my type, and there was like one line where I was like, yeah, this is my type. I want to see if I can find it because I thought it was so funny. Okay, here's a description of the man. Okay, here it is. He looked older than 30 and younger than 40, was of medium height and weight, with a quiet, unobtrusive manner which seemed to ask that he be let alone. So he's very bookish. I think he like runs a newspaper or something, and he's like not immediately infatuated with her. Their like little plot is very like tense because they never actually have like a real moment, and he like dotes on her every whim. He like reads to her, lends her things, and takes care of her in a way that's like very gradual. Now that I'm saying that out loud, it also sounds a lot like Funny Face and the plot between those two characters, even though Fred Astaire is like shockingly older than Audrey Hepburn in the movie. But like the trajectory of those two characters' romance is like very similar, very gradual, very sweet. So she's like here with this character. He begins to fall for her, and then it's never actually stated, but I think she realizes that she's pregnant, and she like writes this, she like is rejuvenated by this in some way, or she just like doesn't get a job and realizes she wants to be taken care of and is rejuvenated by that, and she writes a letter to her husband Cazot, and she goes home to him, and the like the bookish gentleman that fell in love with her like takes her to the train, checks her bag, like sees her off. And the depiction of the husband that she initially leaves, I think, is really fascinating because Chopin does a great job of, like, showing how much of the resentment is born out of just, like, a general incompatibility and out of her own, like, resentment towards the institution of marriage and not necessarily him. And there are parts of the story that are extremely sympathetic where it, like, tries to get into the mind of the husband, and he's like, I don't understand why she doesn't like me. If she doesn't like me, why did she marry me? And yeah, so backtracking to two things. When I said initially that I feel like Chopin writes these like two different types of male characters, I think Chopin is negotiating this thing in her head that a lot of women deal with, especially now, I think, where it's like, for myself, for example, it's hard to see myself married just by nature of, like, relationships that I've had and how they've ended and, like, real feelings and, like, pain and things that I'm still wrestling with and trying to understand. But at the end of the day, I have been in, like, a long, extremely involved relationship. I did, like, fall for someone. We were, like, compatible for a very long time, and I appreciated the comfort. It felt nice to be desired and, like, looked after and cared for. And, like, even though Chopin isn't really a fan of the institution of marriage across all of her work, you can tell she still wants, she doesn't want to be alone. And that reminds me a lot of this quote in Reflecting Men at Twice Their Natural Size by Sally Klein, where it talks about for women who don't, like in the 50s through the 70s, for women who don't conform to like what's expected of them, like the thing that's always held over their head during that time period is like loneliness. And a lot of Chopin's writing, especially in The Awakening and some of the other shorts, like talk about how lovely it is to be left alone as a woman. And I definitely feel like that sometimes, like when I wake up first thing in the morning, there's nothing like more delicious than being alone, drinking like cups and cups of coffee, which is why I've switched to decaf, and just like reading for hours and listening to music. But I think I get these like scaries at night, or whenever I feel like really stressed out or like anxious or just lonely, like I don't want to be alone. And you know, there's like family there, there's friendship, but there's nothing like a partner who you know, like there's nothing like that sort of a connection. And I think that that's what Chopin really wrestles with, like that tension between like the fear of loneliness but also the fear of being known, because both are extremely scary, both are equally scary. And I don't know if there's an answer for that. But the second thing I wanted to turn to after mentioning the story with the husband Kezo and Athenais, the young girl, or woman, whatever, is that when you kind of divorce yourself from society, when you say like, oh, I'm going to take off my mask and I'm going to be myself, a lot of the time I feel like it comes with this really harmful notion that everyone else is like dumb, that everyone else is like, I'm thinking of the word insipid. I don't know if it means what I want it to mean, but it feels right here. that everyone else is like almost like a sheep, right? Like, and I've definitely felt like that sometimes. Like, I think because of how like literary a lot of my life has been, I think I've been in environments that are definitely like more inclined towards snobbery. Like, I think of going to Princeton and then like being in this religion class my senior year and hearing the way that they talked about like evangelicals and Christianity in the Midwest, where like my family's Midwestern, a lot of my family's like very religious, like I'm religious, but to hear people like make fun of that and be like, well, like they don't know what's going on, it made me realize the cruelty in that type of a perspective for someone else. And I think that you see that in Plath's work a lot, like in The Bell Jar especially. She thinks of everyone else as like an idiot. And Esther the character, not necessarily Plath, but like Esther the character, thinks of everyone else as an idiot. And even when other characters express, like that other, the character that actually does end up committing suicide, like leading up to that moment, Esther sees that character as like dumb, and she sees her pain as like worth less than her own, and she sees that character as like almost like lying all the time. And I think that's the tough thing with choosing to like unsubscribe to the, like the world's values, or to truly like quote wake up, given like the awakening in the title, is the idea that you're waking up from something implies that everyone else is asleep. And like, I just don't think that's fair. I think people are too nuanced. I think people that aren't always, like, bouncing around up in their mind, like, sometimes I'm like, maybe these people haven't figured out, because a quiet mind sounds really, really nice sometimes. It sounds really peaceful, and I know it's why I honestly need to start praying more, praying longer, and, like, meditating. Because I think you just have to afford people more grace. And I think Chopin brings a lot of like really good notes in, and I think just with the stuff that I've read this year, like Sally Klein, like Plath, like some Babbitts, I think I've been on this long train of thought about like female dissociation from the self, and I feel like I've in my own life have begun to practice like re-inhabiting myself, my desires, my perspective. But I think I want to have a heart that's still full of a lot of love. And I don't want to be anxious. And I want to be grateful for each day, you know? And I think in order to do that, like, even if life is a big play, even if we're all just, like, pretending, because what is society if not pretending? I think you have to look around and think, like, whoa, we're all putting on a really beautiful, a really cool, a really nuanced show. And I'm going to love everyone around me, even when I disagree. And I'm going to do my best to acknowledge that everyone has their own interiority. Everyone has their own inner life. And if I'm going to, like, wake up from my life, there are ways to do it without, like, constantly being unhappy with the world that I find myself in. And there are ways to do it without being condescending towards everyone else all the time. Because it's exhausting. It's exhausting and it's soul-sucking. And I think we all deserve, like, a little more than that. Okay, two more quick things. So I was thinking about this. I had a really interesting conversation with a brilliant friend of mine about, like, cheating, about the Madonna whore complex. And I was thinking about this with The Storm, a short story by Kate Chopin. And it's interesting because it's actually a sequel to another short story of hers called The Canadian Ball, which, side note, bring back the serialized novel. That would be so cool. Maybe I'll do that. But so in The Storm, there's this plotline of cheating, pretty much, which cheating in, like, the late 19th century is so interesting because it's, like, they held hands. Like, it's interesting just the impact of, like, smaller, like, physical notions. Or maybe the more it's happening and they're just not writing about it. But the last sentence of the short story is, the storm passed and everyone was happy. And there's this sense that, like, a lot went down and maybe the couples know. But at the same time, like, they don't tell one another. And, yeah. And there's a lot of, like, notions of infidelity in, obviously, The Awakening, because she is married, and some of her other stories. But my friend is, like, so brilliant. I admire her so much. And we were talking about how, from our perspective again, because we're, like, we're not men, but we feel like men sometimes, like, are unfaithful through this, like, oscillation between the Madonna whore complex, right? So if they have, like, a part of themselves that they feel is, like, so, like, evil or dirty, or if they just, like, want to be, quote, bad, then they find, like, a whore figure, so, like, girlfriend, wife, whatever, can remain, like, this Madonna figure to them and doesn't have to know that side of them that's burdened with, quote, burdened with, like, taking care of them or being good. And I think this is a theme I've seen in a lot of literature, I don't read, like, old English stuff because I just don't like it yet. Maybe I'll find something that'll change my mind. But I remember reading, like, clear examples of this in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and in The Sentimental Education, which is, like, both are early 20th century works. So it's, like, you know, it's, like, this thing that's been proven true time and time again. And I'm sure if you talk to any woman who's had a relationship in the 21st century, it's, like, a theme that is constantly being proven true. And if that's, like, in a heteronormative context, if that's something that influences, like, male infidelity, I think Kate Chopin represents this really interesting side of female infidelity, where in her work it almost seems like women are unfaithful in this, like, desire to be desired or to be seen in, like, a new light or to be, like, rediscovered. Because in The Awakening, like, I guess the character that she becomes, like, infatuated with, who becomes infatuated with her as well, they reconnect because she, like, you know, she has all these notions, she has all these things that she's saying about her mind, and everyone else is like, oh, she's crazy, and he's like, no, like, I see you, I hear you, this is so interesting to me. And that's a theme that I think is proven true in a lot of her work. And this is, like, a general thing that just scares me about relationships in general, is this feeling of, like, familiarity. And I think a lot about, like, Renee Girard's theory on mimetic desire with this, like, you know, once we like have someone, once you quote have a person mutually, like there's this introduction of familiarity and you aren't like discovering one another again, so things aren't exciting. And this is one of the things that makes me like really afraid of marriage, because I wonder how much of it is just like this like feeling of desire or the chase of like wanting something that you can't have. And I've had like really brief, you know, like situationships and things where we've like talked about this concept up front, and yet we're still playing like the texting game of like, oh, who can wait the longest and stuff like that. So I don't know, I guess we're like back at Schopenhauer with the mask. Like you can take it off and be like, oh yeah, I want someone who isn't like, who isn't chasing and who isn't like mimetically desiring. But in the real world, it's so much easier to like heart a message and not respond than bare your soul to someone, I guess. If y'all want to read her stories on race that are actually like really sophisticated, like they even get into politics of colorism, which I was really impressed by. One is called At Chenier Caminada. Yeah, and then one is called Does Race Baby. And they're both like pretty sophisticated for a time period within like racial politics, so I was actually pretty impressed. But I want to wrap up on this notion of like this like particular flavor of quote insanity. And like my friend and I were saying, like fast brains, big hearts. Because I feel like this connects so much to the Plath episode, just because I am obviously projecting off to both of these authors and both of these books with just things that I've really been grappling with at this place in my life in my early 20s. So there are two quotes in The Awakening that I annotated that I think really impacted me and really resonated with me. One says, quote, I always feel so sorry for women who don't like to walk. They miss so much, so many rare little glimpses of life. And then one says, she had abandoned herself to fate and awaited the consequences with indifference. So these both come at moments when she's resolved to like be awake and stay awake forever. And she sees the beauty in life. She's like moved to these little tiny things just around the world. But she's also like stirred really quickly. Like, this is a spoiler, but the story ends with her like essentially trying to drown herself, and you don't know if she's successful or not. And this is another parallel to Plath and the bell jar. So I'm curious if Plath had like read this and if she was influenced by it at all. But the other quote is, she had abandoned herself to fate and awaited the consequences with indifference. And I think indifference is such an important word here, because as people with fast brains and big hearts, I think you know, you like take off your mask, you like bare your soul to the world, and then maybe you feel like one rejection or five rejections, or if you're on social media, like hundreds of rejections all the time, and it really hurts. And I know Carsey Edwards has some really good quotes on this about like anger and indifference is like a defense mechanism, because if you're preemptively angry at everyone all the time, if you're like rejecting them in your head before they can reject you, then that's a defense mechanism, right? Like they don't get to know you, so even if they do reject you, they're not like rejecting the real you. And I just think there has to be like some sort of happy medium, because I think bouncing back and forth and back and forth can be really good for art, I think, in like an extremely controlled environment. But feeling things that deeply every day, like for myself at least, I just don't think it's sustainable. And I want to be more intentional about when I lean into that and when I don't. And my ex said something that really stuck with me. My ex was like very smart and very thoughtful. And he had said something about, I think it was like Murphy's Law, and how, you know, the world is chaos. Like, the world is chaos. And for me, at least, as I get older, I understand, like, how much of it is out of my control. And, like, the more life that I live, the more stressed out I get, that I, like, have this imprint on the world that's just, like, growing and, like, sprawling and, like, flowing from my fingers that I have to let go. And this stresses me out the most on social media, I think, because this idea that this like canonized version of myself lives online that I like have to release out there and I have no control over is really terrifying. And we could get into like self-disgust and like Nietzsche here as well, but we won't. But no, we'll just talk about my ex instead. No, I think like within Murphy's Law, I think it's Murphy's Law, like there is beauty in trying to rein it in and like trying to control that oscillation or that pendulum, understanding that you never fully will. And I think this ties into like other stuff I've talked about all year, like We by Simeon, my favorite book, and The Mind's Eye by Hofstadter, and just like the beautiful little STEM side of like art and life as well, because that's like the dance of the universe, right? It's like it is chaotic, it is stressful, but there's beauty in trying to rein in the chaos, and there's like beauty and compassion and self-compassion and trying to mitigate the stress in a way that shows grace to both you and the people around you. And yeah, that's what I'm working on. And sometimes I'm doing a good job, sometimes I'm probably doing a bad job, but hopefully I'll end up somewhere in between and generally content. And I want to wrap up with this quote from the story that I said is now my like favorite short story, Athenaïs. The bookish one, the one that I said is probably my type. The young woman says that she's just like generally discontent with life, and she kind of explains that everything, quote, everything seemed wrongly arranged in the world and no one was permitted to be happy in their own way. And he says to her that he's sorry she has discovered the primordial fact of existence so early in life, end quote. And, you know, I think that it's interesting, like, this depiction of the dynamic between the two is the one that, like, I felt the most, like, attracted to. Like, I was like, oh, I like their dynamic. Because for me, I guess that's how I see, like, a marriage long term. That's how I see, like, a sustainable relationship is, like, so many things in the world don't make sense, and it just, like, is the way that it is. Because our own existence doesn't really make sense. We can get into that another time. That's very, like, a very Vonnegut conversation. But I think that's something that I'll come to really appreciate in a partner when I find someone. Because I'm realizing, like, it's cool to be cerebral. It's cool to have these conversations. But it's also cool to have someone where you can complain and say, like, nothing makes sense. And they're like, yeah, nothing makes sense. And you're like, oh, what are we going to do? And the answer is like, let's go on a walk or let's watch like stupid TV or a really beautiful movie. Because, you know, we only have so much time. And I think it's worth finding someone to spend it with where you don't feel like you have to perform. You don't feel like you have to put on your mask. But you also don't feel like you're bearing your soul all the time because there's someone that you can just be with. Like, it's not someone who's propelling you to wake up. It's not someone who's demanding you to, like, suppress your true self, but it's just someone that you're not even aware of yourself with, someone that you can almost, like, melt into one another. And to me, like, I think I'll know it when I find it, and I hope that it'll feel like home, and I hope I find them soonish. I don't know. I'm 22. We'll see.